economic peace possible? Can we plan forward for world peace? Down.
America's town meeting is on the air. Town Hall and the extensive blue network of the National Broadcasting Company thank an open discussion problem. The guests for those how they can help America's town meeting of the air, send a self-addressed envelope to Town Hall, 3 West New York City, giving the date on which you wish to be present. A limited number of tickets for the general public are available each week, and requests will be filled in the order received. I'll take pleasure in presenting our moderator, B. Denny Jr., president of Town Hall and founder and director of America's Town Meeting of the Air, Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors. Of all the puzzles that have faced mankind since he developed the machine age, none have been more perplexing nor yet more interesting than the one involving world trade and the attendant economic adjustments among and between the various countries. Last week, we considered the consequences of advancing science in the field of communications. Tonight, it is advancing science in the field of transportation and communication that give rise to this particular problem. In a world seething with political and economic conflict, the former Premier of Belgium and one of Europe's most distinguished citizens, the Honorable Paul van Zeelen, advanced an economic plan for world peace about a year ago, which has set many people to thinking seriously about his proposals as a means of preventing another world war. Our political approaches to the problem appear rather futile just now. At least we should explore the possibilities of an economic approach. We are grateful to Mr. van Zeelen and to the members of our panel for discussing some of the more important aspects of his plan in an effort to understand their implications. Seated here on the platform with us are Mr. Thomas J. Watson, President of the International Business Machines Corporation and of the International Chamber of Commerce, Dr. James Harvey Rogers, Sterling Professor of Political Economy at Yale University, who's had wide experience in international economics and finance, Mr. Leland Rex Robinson, Investment Counselor and Lecturer at Columbia University and a trustee of the Institute of International Education, and last but not least, the very charming lady in our midst, a brilliant economist of Chicago, Dr. Ruth Alexander. At the close of Dr. van Zeelen's address, we will hear from each member of the panel. And then the audience here in Town Hall will ask its questions. And before we conclude, there will be questions from the Second School Broadcast Conference meeting in Chicago, Illinois. It's now my very great pleasure to present the Honorable Paul van Zeelen, former Premier of Belgium, on the subject, Is an Economic Plan for World Peace Possible? Mr. van Zeelen.
I remember a shrewd observation made to me a few weeks ago by an American teacher. He said, there is too much talk about isolation. Once you discuss so heavily such a thing, it has already gone. Maybe the same idea applies also to peace. In times of real peace, you hear very little about it. People enjoy it in the way they breathe air or they drink water or they enjoy the sun. Peace seems to them a normal, usual, almost ordinary state of affairs. And probably, no one thinks it should be mentioned and emphasized as the most precious gift of destiny. But those times are far away. Never has the word peace been more often pronounced as in this period. In fact, 99 times out of 100, when somebody today speaks of peace, he thinks of war in the immediate background. The state of affairs in Europe actually is one of the greatest confusion. The order based upon the peace treaties of 1919 has practically disappeared. Judgment on these treaties and on the manner in which they were applied during the post-war period may be divergent. Most of them may be severe. I think rightly severe on many parts. But at least, these treaties contain certain principles of order. Some definite elements of organization in the international relations. Today, they have vanished. And up to now, they have not been replaced by any new workable system or even by any new acceptable principle of reorganization. The nationalistic tendencies, which were so strong after the war and which culminated in the totalitarian systems, display no signs of weakening at all. To the contrary, all around the world, the disregard for the pledged word has come to the top. At this very time, while statesmen are exchanging new promises not to have recourse to war, big nations are increasing the pace of the rearmament race. And every one of us, even the most pacifist, realizes that today, the first step to be made is to rearm rapidly in order at least to neutralize any threatening superiority and to reestablish a necessary equilibrium. At the same time, our conceptions of public and private right have been upset and disrupted by moves promoted either by national or political considerations, which have led to extreme hardships for thousands and even millions of human beings. There have been times in history when sending somebody into exile was considered a heavy punishment. Today, being allowed to find a place to exile oneself would seem to many a blessing. When we say that confusion and disequilibrium mark the European state of affairs, we should understand that the same applies to world affairs. Other continents than Europe are equally in a turmoil, and the direct effects of European difficulties are felt everywhere, either politically or economically. Clearly, the world is getting smaller and smaller, year after year, thanks to technological progress. But emphasizing the confusion and complexity of the present time is probably the easiest part of what I'm expected to do today. Now we come to the truly difficult point. To remedy this confusion, what can we do? Should we try to do something? Would it not be better to just wait and see, watching developments? Here I feel a profound conviction. If the statesmen of the world would take such an attitude of waiting and seeing, then mankind would soon be faced with the world. Peace is not a natural outgrowth of things. The normal outcome of disorder, of confusion, is conflict and war. Peace must be conquered. It must be organized, and organized on a solid basis. We must do something. We must acknowledge the changes in the situation and find again a new system or a new way to organize international relationships throughout the world. And problems of today are complex. They present both political and economic aspects in most cases. Is it better to approach the difficulty on the political field or on the economic field? It doesn't matter, provided that something is done in the way of a solution. But you, who are listening to me, do you think that today, things being as they are, it is likely that a direct political approach to the difficulty in international relations could be successful. I am afraid the answer must be negative. So it seems to me there is only one possibility left. It is an economic approach to the towns. And about economics, there is one important good feature we should always keep in mind. I remember a slogan that the governor of the National Bank in Belgium used to remind me when I went into business. He said, a good business, in order to be really good, must actually prove itself good for both parties interested in the transaction. Otherwise, if it is only to the interest of one of the parties concerned, in the long run, it will turn to be a disappointment. And if this is true in private business, it is still much more true in international economics. Agreements, exchanges in international economics are in the long run profitable only if and when they are in the interest of all the parties concerned. And in fact, economic problems, if approached with the necessary goodwill, yield to solutions which can be made to serve the interest of all. So in these times of nationalistic tendencies, the economic method is more likely at the starting point to appeal to and fit into the considerations and the reactions of most nations. Of course, there are innumerable obstacles along the way. These obstacles are inherent to the actual facts of economic intercourse. But, in spite of all difficulties, we must go ahead. How are we going to proceed? Here, I'll refer to the report I handed at the beginning of this year to the governments of France and England at their request. First of all, I must confess that some of the possibilities which were open when the report was handed have already vanished forever. In a world profoundly changing, do not think that you can pigeonhole a report for a year or so, then come back to it and find everything all right. There is a French saying that opportunity has only one head, and if you miss it, you miss everything. In spite of that saying, I think still that the general directions and the big lines indicated in that report are yet today adapted to our necessities. Moreover, I see no practical, immediate possibilities in any other direction. In that report, the idea was already to approach the problem in a very practical manner, with a limited scope, using the most cautious method of realization. Today, I should insist still more strongly on the necessity of urging at the start only a moderate change, a quite modest proposal. The scope of the attempted agreement should be limited, in my opinion, to a few points on which it would be easy to ascertain the probability of collaboration by the most important countries in the world. A few points like the smoothing of tariffs, the enlargement of quotas, the untying of exchange regulations, the extension of short-term credit facilities, and so on. The method of approach should be simple and cautious, but of course, without the leadership of a few of the big countries in the world, nothing could be done. On the other hand, I think that if these countries would take a definite stand along these lines, appealing to others in a fair way, on a footing of complete equality, economic equality, the response would be very large and quite ready throughout the greatest part of the world. So if a start were made, if it were possible to take one step, only one, even a small one, but one in the direction of expansion of trade, the importance of it would be tremendous, because it would carry the proof that people, if the world, are again ready to collaborate on equal, solid, profitable, peaceful basis. Later on, a second step might be made. It would probably be much easier. And after a few of these little modest achievements, something worthy of the scientific progress of our age could finally be realized. And then, of course, the way would be paved for a true and lasting political appeasement. Don't ask me whether I think that the chances to see things developing like that are great. I would just retort with another question: is there anything else to do? I know, in the face of developments particularly hard to understand or to accept, I know how difficult it is sometimes to keep our impartiality. But who believes that war would solve anything, would bring any good? We have had the striking experience of the last war. Should the problems of before the war be easier to solve after the war? Of course, as a Belgian, I know that sometimes there are cases when you have nothing left to do but fight. But as long as there is one single chance to avoid war, it should be seized, and everything toward organizing peace should be attempted. May I recall here the words of an American statement, which an American statesman used before me a few weeks ago. He said, "The most important thing in life is to learn how to collaborate with the inevitable. Let us do this as best we can." After all, when you consider the paramount importance of safeguarding peace, no effort should prove too great to achieve such an end. If we don't succeed, if after all the catastrophe of war comes again upon mankind, at least we'll know that we did everything to avoid it. And if we succeed, then we'll have gained everything. Because the very day peace will be on a well-organized, solid, lasting basis, then the tremendous possibilities opened by the recent progress in every technological direction will finally materialize themselves. And then mankind will find itself again on the threshold of a new period of unlimited moral, intellectual, and material possibility. And I hope you will allow me to say, by closing this brief statement, that such a goal seems to me worthy of the increased strength and of the growing greatness of the United States of America.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Zalen. And now it's my pleasure and privilege to present a distinguished American businessman, the President of the International Chamber of Commerce and President of the International Business Machines, Mr. Thomas J. Watson. Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Van Zeelen, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great privilege for me to be here tonight, especially on the platform with Dr. Van Zeelen. I've had the pleasure of cooperating with him in Europe in connection with the International Chamber of Commerce. I have studied this plan, which is known as the Van Zeelen Plan. Dr. Butler said several years ago, all of the problems of the world could be settled easily if men were only willing to think. Dr. Van Zeelen's great contribution to our world is that he has made more people think since his report came out than any other man that I know of. The reason everybody is thinking about his report is because it's based on the thing that's uppermost in the minds of nearly all the people in the world. I've just had the privilege in the last 15 months of visiting 21 countries and talking with the political, industrial, financial, and cultural leaders. And I find that nearly all of the people today are thinking more about peace than ever before. We all owe great tribute to Prime Minister Chamberlain for his courageous action in stopping the war, preventing the war, because the last war took a toll of 33 million lives and cost the world $338 billion. And every thinking person in the world who has studied the results of the past war knows that another war would end civilization as we understand it. And no one can predict what sort of a civilization would follow. Now, the reason I am in favor of this plan in the main is because of the fact that my country is so dependent upon other countries. Let's just for a moment think what has made this country as great as it is. It's because we received in this country people from all countries of the world, regardless of race or religion. And I trust that we will continue that policy for all time. We've also received goods from the different countries. And when I say we're so dependent upon other countries, I'll cite just a few simple examples. When you see an American automobile coming down the street, you say, there's an American automobile. If you called in the chemists and engineers and analyzed all parts of that car, you'd find there are 57 different ingredients in that car that cannot be produced in the United States. In our great steel industry, you'll find that it requires 40 different ingredients coming from different countries to manufacture our high-grade steel. If you analyze the various things, you'll find that the talents of the people and the quality of the soil are unequally distributed throughout the world, which makes it possible for some people in some countries to produce things to advantage and distribute them to other countries, and we must make it possible for those people to exchange those goods for the things that they cannot produce to advantage. I'm very glad to have had these few minutes to speak to you tonight, and I'm sorry that I can't remain for the rest of your meeting.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lott. Mr. Watson has to go to catch a train, so we had to cut his address short, and he's just leaving the platform. It's now my pleasure and privilege to present Mr. Leland Rex Robinson, Investment Counsel, lecturer at Columbia University, and member of the board of the Institute for International Education. Mr. Robinson.
When Mr. Van Zeelen released his report in January of this year, the outlook was by no means promising. However, he reminded us at that time that to await a serener atmosphere before making any major effort for international collaboration would be sterile and even dangerous. The situation seems worse today, but it comes to us with greater force than it did 10 months ago that to give up efforts at international appeasement in the face of urgently increasing need for action is unreasonable and defeatist. As a matter of fact, there has come in the wake of Munich a real victory for the principles of freer trade. I refer to the recent signing of the reciprocal trade agreement with Great Britain and her colonies, and to the renewal and liberalization at the same time of the agreement with Canada. The unexpectedly prompt conclusion of these negotiations puts the keystone in Secretary Hull's new gateway for world commerce. It represents, in a sense, a closing of the ranks among the Anglo-Saxon peoples, and thus it reflects the political anxieties resulting from German aggression. But in letting down bars to trade on the most favored nation principle, this agreement will work toward a lessening of international tensions and give a good lead all along the line in financial, economic, and political reconstruction. Of course, there's no blinking the fact that Germany is resorting to the most desperate expedients to increase her exports and thus her imports. Germany is artificially maintaining high values for her mark in paying for imports and low values in quoting on exports. She is reselling some of these imports at ruinous prices on world markets. But it is not our cue either to surrender to this threat or to strike an attitude of superiority. Let him who is without blame cast the first stone. Remember that in 1930 our government added new tariff barriers to what was already one of the highest protective systems in the world. Remember that in 1932 Great Britain and the Dominions followed our lead in laying foundations for a Chinese wall around the British Empire. The partial closing of these vast trade areas added greatly to the difficulties of the so-called debtor or have-not countries which so badly needed foreign exchange to pay their obligations abroad and to command essential raw materials. So we've all been in an economic armament race as futile as the piling up of munitions and fully as explosive in its ultimate effects. As long as goods, services, capital, and men could cross national frontiers with relative freedom, political boundaries had little economic meaning. Obstructions applied by more fortunately situated countries have driven their less favored neighbors into an obsession for national self-sufficiency to be brought about by fair means or by foul. Resulting struggles now keep the threat of war fresh, and this in turn quickens the efforts for exclusive advantages. Thus, a vicious circle. Now we're trying hard enough, and it's not too late to salvage international trade conducted on the time-honored principles of mutual advantage. Germany's inroads upon American and British commerce have not yet reached grave proportions. In the United States, it is far more important now to increase imports than exports. The inclusion at the present time of more than half of all world trade within the potential scope of the reciprocal trade agreements gives a definite advantage to those countries broadly committed to fair trade. This includes practically all the so-called democracies. If this advantage is boldly pursued, eliminated some driving the states to a regimentation of their trade, appeasement over broader areas will become possible, and many other fruits of Mr. Van Zalen's plan will come, I am sure, within the range of practical politics.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rock.
We pause a moment for station identification.
Back in Town Hall in New York City, continuing a program of America's Town Meeting of the Air, we just heard former Premier Paul Van Zalen present his plan, discuss some aspects of his plan, under the title, is an economic plan for world peace possible. Mr. Thomas J. Watson of the International Business Machines and Mr. Leland Rex Robinson have just commented on it. It's now my pleasure to introduce our third speaker, Dr. Ruth Alexander, economist of Chicago. Dr. Alexander.
Mr. President, Mr. Van Zeeland, and ladies and gentlemen, I think the question before us tonight should properly be, what are the implications of the Van Zeeland plan for the United States? What do we stand to give? What do we stand to gain or to lose? I speak as an American citizen, first and last. I leave it to my betters, the humanitarians, to be world citizens, first and last. What the United States stands to give is plenty, as usual. We are to become once more Santa Claus or Shylock, depending on the mood of our European commentators. As an able summary epitomizes the plan, I quote, "The plan contemplates either the deposit by the Federal Reserve Bank of an undetermined amount of gold with the Bank of International Settlements at Basel, or the establishment of a bookkeeping credit against gold earmarked for that purpose and retained in this country. With this deposit or credit, the Bank of International Settlements would then make loans on such terms as it saw fit," unquote. That, then, is what we would stand to give. We are to broaden the base of our lending, spending policy to include Europe. You understand it's been so highly successful over here that they want to come in under the big tent with us. And what do we stand to gain? First, provided we furnish either the money or the credit for Europe to buy our goods, we obviously stand to gain in expansion of markets and reduction of unemployment.